It's been very tense. I've been in the courtroom for two of the first 5 days. I had to go to DC for work later this week, so I couldn't stay there, but I'll be back tomorrow. They're pushing very hard to not have this stuff labeled as privacy technology. They're pushing to have it labeled as like something that only bad actors use. The judge and the prosecution, they object whenever Roman Storm's defense says like, oh no, this is like privacy, blah, blah, blah. So the defense needs support, you know, and also speak up. I mean, speak up online if you believe that this prosecution is unfair. And I would say that's the biggest thing, probably funding the people who are already involved, given the fact that Tornado Cash is already at trial and Samurai is going to trial, I think, in November. Yeah, these are very pivotal cases. For people who don't know, please do your homework. If you Google the PGP wars of the 1990s, I can't think of the Phil Zimmerman, I'm pretty sure, but if you Google Zimmerman and the PGP wars, PGP was called Pretty Good Privacy, and this was the fight over encryption on the internet in America, and this was more to encrypt messaging, but like not like WhatsApp, just but any sort of information on the internet. The government argued that it should not exist. The average person shouldn't be able to use encryption because it's a munition, meaning like it's a gun or it's like a weapon. And the way that case got won, the way that the defense won that case, is they printed the code on a t-shirt and said code is free speech. So it's a really amazing case and you should understand it, but now the Tornado Cash and Samurai cases are sort of what comes next, using encryption plus privacy preserving technology to send value across the internet. And will this be allowed? We don't know. This is how big the stakes are. Are we going to be able to transact privately across the internet? Whether you agree with whether we should or not, that's up to you, but it's something to pay attention to if you care one way or the other. And I have plenty of people who think Tornado Cash, it's terrible, blah, blah, blah. They're in my comments telling me that. And that's fine. Everybody's entitled to their opinion. But I would say pay attention. And I would just say, just remember, like, maybe you're not an activist or you've never been debanked or you're not on a terrorist list, but it happens. It sometimes happens to the best of us out there. You know, the people that I think are on those lists never expected to be on those lists. And to be able to accept donations anonymously to support some of the work they're doing when they're not clearly not terrorists, the total opposite. It's really important, and you're fighting to sort of preserve this technology, you're fighting to preserve the work that these people are doing as well. So just keep that in mind. Follow along as best as possible. The case will not be broadcast. It will not be rebroadcast. We can't even have our computers in the courtroom. All we're doing is taking handwritten notes and then coming out and writing about it.
Hello guys, welcome once again to another episode of BitCorner Podcast. Right, crazy rides the last couple of times. We have been discussing from Nostr to Ordinals to Bitcoin adoption in Europe. We have covered a lot of things also in the Barcelona Cypher conference. Those interviews were crazy, but now we're going further. So right now, today, this episode is going to be quite interesting because we will try to cover a lot about politics, but not just in the US, not just in El Salvador, but in general, in global, because I think there's a lot of things happening right now in Bitcoin. And that's why I brought someone that actually that's one of his expertise in the Bitcoin fields. So I don't want to extend anymore because I think there's a lot of things to cover. But thank you, Frank Corva, for being in the podcast. Welcome, man.
How's it going, guys? Thank you for having me. Appreciate it, Juan. Thank you for the invite.
No, thanks to you. First of all, before starting, as I already told you in private, but congratulations on your new position. That's awesome.
Thank you.
To represent Bitcoiners in the White House. We'll discuss a little bit about that as well. But yeah, if you can share a little bit about yourself so people have a previous context of you, and then we can go deeper into Bitcoin and your rabbit hole journey.
Yeah, totally. So yes, my current position, I cover the White House and politics more broadly. Because of a few things that have happened recently, I try to cover mostly the United States, not because I don't want to cover the rest of the world, but because sometimes you have to sort of have a good understanding of a political system before you start covering someone working within that system. But I cover some of it a little bit internationally as well. And then I also, for a while, I was writing for Forbes, documenting a lot of what's happening in what gets termed the Bitcoin circular economy. So like Bitcoin Beach, Bitcoin Akazi, So I think that stuff is great. And then adoption in Africa and Latin America, two continents on which I've lived. I've lived in Venezuela, I lived in Ghana, I lived in Namibia. So yeah, I'm really passionate about that as well. I used to run a podcast called New Renaissance Capital, where I would speak with a lot of those people as well. And I actually maybe touch on it quickly. I do advising to Heatbit. I'm really into the decentralization of Bitcoin mining, the actual hardware. I want to see more people mining, and I think heating your home. I know talking about that during the summer for you and I is not a fun conversation maybe, but heating your home while mining Bitcoin, I think, is a really cool thing. So, yeah, that's what I have going on right now.
Awesome. That's super interesting. Yeah, actually, I had to turn off my what is the name of this guy? Little guy. My Bitax. This is too hot.
Yeah.
Summers. So I told him, rest a little bit.
We'll
meet again. during
take a break. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So there's a lot of things to cover, but actually I want to talk because probably people will like to know about your newest position in the White House. So how's to be a Bitcoiner in the White House?
Yeah. How do you feel about it? I think the way that you put it is really important. So there are other journalists who cover crypto more broadly there. I sometimes have to cover crypto if Bitcoin is included in it, meaning like if there's a bill that covers crypto and it's going to affect Bitcoin, I cover it. But generally speaking, I think the way you put it is correct. I am I think of myself as a Bitcoin enthusiast or a Bitcoiner first, and then sort of doing this other work maybe second. And I think that, and I can say that because I have a bias. You know, I wouldn't have started writing for Bitcoin Magazine if I didn't like Bitcoin first. And Bitcoin Magazine, we're a thesis-driven publication. We believe that Bitcoin is the crypto asset that sort of wins, and any other technology in the crypto space that gets developed that's cool ends up coming to Bitcoin as well. So yes, to represent, in a way, to represent the Bitcoin community in the White House is, I don't even know that I fully processed it mentally. It's a totally kind of surreal thing. And I think all I can do is ask questions that I think we care about. So I got to speak with Carolyn Leavitt, who's the press secretary for the White House, on Thursday. And the question I asked her was, I said, you know, can we, President Trump was in this room, the press room, talking about a $600 de minimis tax capital gains exemption. A few weeks ago, can we still expect something like that? And, you know, my question was, the point of that question, it was one half of the question that I asked. The other one was about banning CBDCs. The point is to say, like, hey, you know, in the Bitcoin community, we care not just about Bitcoin as a store of value, which the government really doesn't seem to have a problem talking about that way, but also as money. You know, it's people don't talk about Bitcoin as money, at least in the United States, that much, because they have a relatively stable currency, the dollar, though the dollar has lost a lot of value in the last 10 years, 20 years. But it's important that we do talk about it as money. And, you know, if the president can talk about it as money, I can follow up and ask questions about Bitcoin as money. That was my thought process. And she was happy to respond to that. And she did respond to it and said that they're looking into ways to legislate that into law. Hopefully they'll add some sort of an amendment to a future bill where we can have de minimis exemptions. Now, a lot of hardcore Bitcoiners might say to me, who cares? Just spend your Bitcoin, do what you want. That's fine. I totally agree with that. If you want to just spend your Bitcoin, that's fine. But the other side to that equation that we're not paying attention to, if we want to approach it like that, is unless, one, it's a good thing for the government to acknowledge Bitcoin as money, to say, you know what, if you want to spend some Bitcoin and you don't have to pay your taxes on it, that's great. I think that's a positive step. It's a step in the right direction in the United States. Two, you're going to need businesses to get more comfortable accepting it. We're seeing Steak and Shake in New York. I think there's two places. We have PubKey. They accept it, but that's like a Bitcoin bar, so they have to. And then there's a restaurant uptown called Safari. It's owned by an Ethiopian gentleman, and they accept Bitcoin as well. But I think there might be a coffee shop now too. But if it becomes more normalized as money, then more people will use it as such, and more stores will accept it, and it won't be such a taboo thing. So I think we just sort of, at the White House, I don't think we're going to have these huge moments where I just sort of change the future of Bitcoin because of a question I asked, but it's more of an incremental thing. Hopefully we can keep the conversation moving forward and to build with the supporters that we have, like Senator Lummis has been great. Yeah. And Nick Begich, who's a new congressperson from Alaska. He's the one who introduced the Bitcoin Act in the House. So there's people doing good stuff. Nick Begich, I was telling you off camera, you know, it's surprising there are Bitcoiners in the in government. Nick Begich bought his first Bitcoin on Mt. Gox in 2012, bought 7 Bitcoin for $100, and has held them since then. He also bought $5,000 worth of Bitcoin for his company at the time and kept them on Mt. Gox, and they all got lost and he got liquidated. So yeah, he lost those, whatever, how much that had been. I don't even know how many Bitcoin that was, but he got some sort of payout for it, but it was a fraction of what he had. But yeah, the point is that, you know, my job, I think, is to look for the people who are really proponents of the technology and or look for the people who are willing to write positive legislation about it. And to build with them. That's it. There's no magic wand. Just because we have a Bitcoin reporter in the White House doesn't mean that I'm going to magically start affecting everything President Trump thinks about Bitcoin. It doesn't work like that. But, you know, we get some idea of what they're thinking. They get some idea of what we're thinking, and we just keep the conversation moving forward.
Yeah. You mentioned something important. Like, for example, there are core Bitcoiners, like, for example, Senator Loomis, among others. But do you think, like, having them as players in the White House can help to even embrace other politicians, even embrace Bitcoin?
No.
Or it is just political theater?
No.
There's a real conviction?
Yeah, there's a spectrum. I would say some people, like real conviction to political theater. I think those are good ways to put it. Some people are new and just want to get involved with it because it's a hot topic and they know maybe their voters care about it. And that's actually fine with me, to be honest, because I think everybody needs to start somewhere. And if we could actually go to those people, like, I'll give you an example. There's a senator, Senator Jim Justice from West Virginia. He's very clear. He's very open about it. He's very new to Bitcoin, but he's blown away by the enthusiasm of the community. You know, I know people in the policy world that have spent legitimate time with him, you know, explaining it to him. So while he may have kind of gotten into it because he saw an opportunity, he's now taking the time to learn more about it. Someone like Senator Loomis, she's made it clear. I think she owns 5 Bitcoin. And also she represents a state that has some of the most progressive state level Bitcoin and crypto legislation, Wyoming. And I know that someone like Caitlin Long, one of my favorite people in the Bitcoin space, is one of the people who constantly keeps Senator Loomis up to date on things. I think a clip of me and the White House went viral on Thursday, and what's her name? Caitlin Long shared it, and I saw she said, like, this is more important than the Genius Act, you know, talking about Bitcoin as money in the White House. And Senator Loomis retweeted it. She doesn't have to retweet that kind of stuff. If she didn't really care, she wouldn't have to go and retweet that kind of stuff. She could just do what she's doing behind the scenes, which is great too. So yeah, it's you know, with all this stuff, my suggestion to people is, like, to look at things like a Venn diagram. And also, this doesn't just apply to politicians, it applies to the crypto space as well.
Yeah.
See where your incentives overlap. See where you have in common with people versus what divides you from people. So with politicians, okay, if you sort of see eye to eye on these things, great. And then with the crypto space, I say that too, because the next major act that's going through the U.S. government that's working its way through right now is the Clarity Act. And there's a section of the Clarity Act, Section 110, that says you will not need a money transmitter license if you're building non-custodial Bitcoin technology. That's not the exact language in it, but what that does is it sets up a situation where the Samurai or Tornado Cash case couldn't happen again, where you couldn't go and prosecute open source developers who are creating non-custodial technology. And this also has impacts for DeFi and everything else, all that stuff. I'm not really into that world, DeFi, whatever, but if we have aligned incentives here, we should be working together to get this bill across the line. Like, I don't like using the word shitcoiners and this and that. Not because I don't think that of certain tokens. I would just rather try to focus on, like, what can we do that's positive together versus calling each other names and blah, 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 blah. So that's my approach. It's sort of like, let's find the people who want to work with us, who want to have conversations, who want to build something with us from a legislative angle, and let's just build some small victories along the way. So,
yeah, actually, that was going to be sooner or later the next question that I wanted to ask you, like, how can Bitcoin bridge the gap between, you know, the main street and not just talking about the White House, but let's say Wall Street, to between the own bank and the global financial system, let's say.
Yeah, The best way I could put that is I don't know if there's like a technical one answer I can give you, but as with Alex Gladstein recently, the chief strategy officer for the Human Rights Foundation, and he was at PubKey speaking, and he said something along the lines of, "Yeah, all this money coming in from Wall Street, like whatever government interest, all that, like it's all good for Bitcoin." The reason I think so, for let's just talk, we could talk about that, like what's happening in the government and Wall Street and how that connects to the global south. Generally speaking, we all want Bitcoin to be more liquid. Another way to put that is we want the price to go higher, but partially because we all like our bags being pumped. I'll say that jokingly, like we like having more purchasing power, we like being wealthier, whatever. The other side to that equation though is that as Bitcoin's market cap gets bigger and bigger, it becomes more stable. Now, it's still going to, I think, sway. There's still going to be huge sways in Bitcoin's price. You know, I think that we're still in that world. But when you compare it to the really early days of Bitcoin, 90-something percent drawdowns and stuff, I don't think we're doing that anymore. So maybe we'll do 50, 60, maybe even 70% drawdowns in the case of like a crash or something. But there's a difference between those numbers and 90, 85, like the really early days of Bitcoin. So the more liquid it is, the closer it gets to being a stable money. Let's put it that way. Granted, from now until, you know, the universe fails, or until, you know, the code does, I don't know, whatever, until Bitcoin fails, which I hope never happens, it's going up forever. You know, it's as long as it gets adopted and used, you know, it's something that will be sort of everything will be falling against Bitcoin forever. And I think that's really fascinating. So I think that I don't think too strategically, I guess, is the way to put it when it comes to like Bitcoin or Wall Street adopting it. I mean, I would tell people, don't buy Bitcoin ETFs. If you want Bitcoin, buy Bitcoin. If you want Bitcoin exposure, okay, buy an ETF, enjoy yourself. But like, it's not the same thing. And with the government looking at it, I will say that living in the United States under the Biden administration, people were scared. You know, it was a tough 4 years for the industry, and people are not as scared anymore. People are building again, and they're more comfortable either running their businesses or starting new businesses because they don't feel like they're going to be debanked or something. So I think wherever we see people embracing it, that's great. There's a lot we have to pay attention to in terms of whether or not the bigger institutions start trying to influence like Bitcoin Core development or, you know, things that could affect the way that the network is used. That stuff we have to be very, very mindful of, no question. But so long as we don't head in that direction, if there's more liquidity, if there's more cash flowing into Bitcoin, it's a good thing for Bitcoin. If there's more people, even politicians, sort of looking at it saying like, wow, this technology is kind of incredible, you know, and really starting to get it, it's a good thing for Bitcoin. And I would just say, given the nature of the protocol, if it's a good thing for Bitcoin and people in the global south are holding it, then it's a good thing for people in the global south. And it's sort of like the rising tide lifts all boats. You know, the only thing I would say is like, I'm not as excited about things. I think it's fine. I think the U.S. should have an SBR, Strategic Bitcoin Reserve, but I'm not like a proponent of like the U.S. should hoard all the Bitcoin and blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't like that idea. Yeah. I think every country should have some Bitcoin. I think every company should have some Bitcoin. I think every person should have some Bitcoin. So I'm in favor of all of that. I just think, you know, I would like for this process of Bitcoin adoption to kind of happen slowly. And I know that sounds weird. A lot of people just want to see hyper Bitcoin Bitcoinization tomorrow. I don't, because I feel like, unfortunately, a lot of people will be left behind, and I don't want that to be the case. I would rather see more grassroots education in the global south or globally where, you know, and then the price just sort of go up over time. We do need the price to go up because that's the best marketing tool for Bitcoin. When it goes up, everybody sort of, especially the people who are new to it, are like, oh my goodness, I got to get some of this thing. But at the same time, I just hope it's kind of a smooth ride, maybe something that plays out over the next, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 years. But we'll see. I mean, I can't control that, but I think more liquidity in Bitcoin, the better it is, the more easily people can start considering it money and using it as money.
Actually, I have a very interesting question talking about that, because there's a hot topic, I think, the recent years, because right now Bitcoin is going mainstream, right? Since, mm-hmm. of course, Donald Trump and elections and everything. Of course, also in El Salvador when Bukele made it a legal tender. And then, well, now it's mainstream because of all the deals that are having with the IMF, etc. So the thing is that globally is going mainstream, right? But some core Bitcoiners or maximalists, whatever you want to call it, are worried that it's losing its, let's say, counter-cultural roots. So how do you see the balance between the growth that the Bitcoin is having and the antithesis of what Bitcoin actually means for, you know, probably the maxis?
Cuando dejas tus activos digitales en un exchange o en custodia de alguien más, te expones a riesgos de terceros no deseados. A diferencia del sistema bancario tradicional, Bitcoin te permite tomar el control total de tus fondos utilizando tus propias claves privadas. Esto te permite ser soberano y esencialmente tu propio banco. Al tomar el control de tus Bitcoin, puedes evitar riesgos innecesarios de terceros. Almacenar tus Bitcoin en custodia de terceros como los exchanges puede exponerte a ataques de actores malintencionados, gobiernos o estafadores que lo único que quieren es apoderarse de tu dinero. Las billeteras de hardware aumentan la seguridad de tu billetera porque tus claves privadas se almacenan en un dispositivo especializado que no está siempre conectado al internet. Como te he dicho antes, mantener tus claves almacenadas en un dispositivo en línea puede exponerte a factores adicionales de ataque, por lo que se recomienda usar una billetera de hardware al almacenar grandes cantidades de Bitcoin durante largos periodos de tiempo. Jade es una billetera de hardware no custodial para Bitcoins y Liquid que ofrece opciones de firma simple y firmas múltiples. Yo personalmente lo utilizo para almacenar mis Bitcoins, ya que me siento mucho más seguro manteniendo mis Bitcoins en una billetera fría que en una almacenada, por ejemplo, en mi teléfono. Si estás pensando en adquirir uno para ti, no olvides utilizar el código de descuento de nuestro show, BitCornerPodcast. De esta forma estarás apoyando directamente el show y además obtendrás un 10% de descuento para la compra de tu billetera fría.
I have to preface that Bitcoin doesn't belong to the maxis. I'll send that message to them now, and I don't. They have no control over whether or not it stays a countercultural force. So let's just start with that. But I'll go back a little bit. I come from the world of like punk rock and independent hardcore and hip hop in New York. Like, so most of you guys probably listening are too young for this, but there's a club called CBGB's in New York City. It's where like the Ramones started and Blonde, like a lot of the early punk rocks. So cool. Yeah. So I've played there. I've hung out there. And beyond that, even at, you know, when I was younger, I got into what I would call like the DIY do it yourself music scene where people put out their own records and book their own shows. And they just didn't wait for permission. They did things their own way, very kind of Bitcoin sort of way. And I've been through this thing of like when all that was counterculture. So I'm trying to think of some bands you might know. So I used to work with bands I was at one of the first shows for a band like My Chemical Romance. I don't know. Something like that. I used to see them play in like a warehouse to like 30 people sort of thing. And so I watched all that stuff go from something that nobody cared about, much like Bitcoin, mm-hmm. however many years ago, only a handful of like weirdos and, you know, punks and blah, blah, blah. And then watched it turn into, you know, those bands playing at Madison Square Garden and huge arenas and everything else. And I watched it and I remember being sad, like, not that I was a huge My Chemical Romance fan in general, but a lot of bands that I loved got bigger. The countercultural vibe sort of shifted as they got bigger. It just became a normal thing. They were on the radio. They were playing big venues. But that's not what Bitcoin is. Like, Bitcoin is not a band that you really like. Yes, there's a culture around it. So another thing that a lot of Bitcoin maxis want is hyper-Bitcoinization. You can't have it be a countercultural thing and have hyper-Bitcoinization at the same time. These are two things that are incompatible. So I understand the whole, like, it's going mainstream, it's losing its culture. I didn't come here for the culture. I love the culture. Don't get me wrong. Like, I came here to see this technology better the lives of human beings. And for that to happen, it has to go mainstream. It can't stay a subcultural thing forever. I think what they're worried about, and rightfully so, and I support their worries here, is that, like, I feel the same way, is that maybe people are stopped, like, they're not learning about self-custody or best privacy practices, mm-hmm. all the things that we care about as Bitcoin enthusiasts. You know, that's what I think that's what they're getting at when they say things like Bitcoin is going mainstream and people you know, if we're just trading paper Bitcoin and Bitcoin treasury companies and Bitcoin ETFs, then like it's losing its purpose. Bitcoin was created as an antithesis or an antidote to what Wall Street has done to money, to what the treasury has done to money. If we completely lose that, it fails. Bitcoin fails. There's no question about it. And that could happen. And I know people don't like to hear that, but it could happen. So it's on all of us to teach people how to use a hardware wallet, how to use wallets, how to use Lightning, how to transact with Bitcoin, how to whatever. And I think that that's the core of what they're getting. And I will say I very much share their concern in that regard, which is why I asked that question to the U.S., you know, to the press secretary of the White House the other day to turn it into part of the national conversation. Because one of the big things that I think as it goes mainstream, if we don't change people's psychology along with it going mainstream to get them to think about it as a new form of money and all this, then we have failed in a way as people who understand Bitcoin and the power of Bitcoin and all that kind of stuff. So I think that there's often some nuance when people say, oh, it's going mainstream. It's like, that's what you want. You want people. Someone asked me when they hired me at Bitcoin Magazine, they said, what do you want to do for Bitcoin Magazine? I said, two things. I want to normalize Bitcoin. I want Bitcoin to become as normal as the internet. I just want people to like use it and not think about it. And the other thing was I want to make Bitcoin Magazine a household name. And I think those two things are sort of symbiotic. They work together because when people are watching a White House press briefing and they hear whatever, this is Frank Corbett from Bitcoin Magazine and I'm talking about Bitcoin as money, you know, we're trying to basically craft a different narrative at a much bigger level at this point. I love the Bitcoin podcast circuit. I think what you're doing is great and all this, but obviously this has a different impact maybe for people who are seeking out this information than it does for people who just happen to turn on their TV on Thursday and see some maniac like myself, you know, asking about Bitcoin in the White House or whatever. I say that facetiously. I'm not a maniac. But my point is just that, yes, as it gets more mainstream, we do have to be mindful of how we're teaching people about this and what the messaging looks like. And not all the messaging, because we're not in control of what BlackRock does. We're not in control of what Donald Trump and the White House does. Like, we can do what's in our control, and in our control, we teach people best practices. You know, we channel our inner BTC sessions, and we become teachers for those around us. So I think that's really what we should keep in mind. Think about what's in your power. And if getting Bitcoin, as it gets bigger, if you want it to spread the right way, quote unquote, where people actually hold it and use it, then do something about it. Teach people about it. Like, let's go. Don't complain about it going mainstream. This is what, you know, eventually it was getting here. There's no question. If it was going to succeed, it was getting here one way or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. You also mentioned that you live in Venezuela, right? And mm-hmm. also, and you have visited El Salvador. So let's talk a little bit about the Global South as well.
Yeah.
I know that we have talked a little bit about that. How do you see the Latin American approach to Bitcoin compared to, let's say, US and China and even Europe?
Yeah.
What are the key differences that you see?
I'd love to, if you don't mind, I lived in Ghana as well and in Namibia in Africa. So I'd love to also include my thoughts on Africa.
Absolutely.
Yeah. In the US, people think about it predominantly as an investment. There's many reasons for that. The money we have is relatively stable. The dollar, though it has lost a lot of purchasing power in my lifetime, the last few decades. So people don't really, and even the financial technology around the dollar, PayPal, Venmo, whatever, it's good enough. People don't really think twice about what they're using. So that's the US. Kind of not, it's cool because it, you know, for someone like me, it's helped me to feel more comfortable financially after having been in a lot of student loan debt. So I'm happy about Bitcoin as an investment. That's great. But when I go to Latin America, I haven't been back to Venezuela since what happened. We can't even get visas anymore to go there. So I'd be curious to see Bitcoin adoption there. I can't really comment on it, but I have been to El Salvador and I have been to two different African Bitcoin conferences and to a few of the four of the circular economies in Africa and one in Latin America. And what I see there is the Bitcoin story playing out the way I would like to see it play out. So people using it as money and also developing technology to solve real problems. And I'll give a shout out to a company here. So there's a company called Tandil let me rewind a little bit. Let's give a shout out to Blink, the Bitcoin Beach wallet. What was initially So Blink is a custodial wallet. I know people have their issues with that. I don't think Blink should be the place that you do all your Bitcoin savings, but it's a cool kind of everyday wallet, really easy to use. The interface is great.
Agreed.
Yeah, and that came from somebody. It was Nicholas Bertley or Bertie, I forget, from Galois, moving to El Salvador, seeing the need, building something that made it easier to onboard people, and then people used it. Amazing. Love it. I've interviewed him before, and I love what he built. In Africa, I was just there for the Africa Bitcoin Conference in Kenya, and I used an app called Tandos, and I used that with my Blink wallet, oddly enough. So Tando, in Eastern Africa, I think it's just Eastern, maybe other parts too, there's a system called M-Pesa. M-Pesa is their mobile money system. And I can't use M-Pesa when I'm in Kenya because I don't have a national ID. You have to sign up for M-Pesa with a national ID. But what the people behind Tando built is a way for me to pay someone in Kenya, whether it's my cab driver or the person serving me food, my restaurant bill, to pay somebody over M-Pesa, which I would not be able to do otherwise. And this makes my life easy because now I don't have to go and trade some dollars for Kenyan shillings and go through that whole process. I pay them over M-Pesa. And on the back end, that payment comes out of a Lightning wallet. And so it comes out of my Lightning. I'm using Bitcoin because that's my preferred currency while I'm in Kenya, and I'm paying people in their digital Kenyan shillings. I know I'm not going to get into how the background works and stuff, but essentially this company, shout out to Jason and Sabina, you know, they created this two people, and it solves a huge problem. So like now every merchant in Kenya doesn't need to accept Bitcoin, but if someone wants to live on a Bitcoin standard in Kenya, you can do that. And there's other apps like this in Europe. There's an app called Bringin that does this. Bringin is great. Yeah. We have Strike in the US, but with Tando, it's also no KYC, no sign up, super easy to use, super, super easy to use. And so when I see people building solutions that are solving real problems for people with Bitcoin, that's the stuff that excites me more than like ETFs in the United States or something like that. It really excites me. There's one connection I'd like to make, if you don't mind. Some people have, I think, kind of alluded to like, well, why'd you stop caring about Africa and Latin America and other places that you covered? I never stopped caring about these things. And I also do a lot of stuff behind the scenes that people don't know about, where I try to stay in touch with what's happening in these parts of the world. If the United States gets Bitcoin policy wrong, it will have a negative impact on the rest of the world. I don't even necessarily agree with that being reality. It just is reality. And China and Russia are not going to get Bitcoin right. India or whatever, I don't trust the other like major poles in the world to get this right. So we need an example, a major power somewhere in the world that says like, we're embracing Bitcoin technology. Because, and I get messages from across Latin America and Africa and in Southeast Asia and other places in the world. I don't love the term, but like the global South, let's say, where they're like, thank you for doing this because now our leaders will take this more seriously. And like, you know, you're taking some of the pressure off of us because we're working with Bitcoin, but it's not like fully permitted here. There's a lot of gray area. What I want to do is like, we can't exist in the gray area forever globally. Bitcoin can't just exist in like it's kind of okay, but it's not. Eventually the powers that be are going to have something to say about it. And we want them to say something good about it. That's it. That's my philosophy. We want the powers that be across the world to essentially say like, okay, this is helping people. Okay, great. Let's have people use it more. So I apologize if that was too much, but you know, I think it's really important what people are building in these places, and the builders need to be protected, and Bitcoin usage needs to be protected. And not that the United States will dictate all of that for the rest of the world, but it obviously, what comes out of the United States often gets copied and pasted globally, or sometimes what comes out of Western Europe, this stuff gets copied and pasted globally. And as we move into a more multipolar world where the United States has these other challengers, like I said, Russia, China, maybe India, even the BRICS and stuff, I want to be part of a country that likes, you know, we call ourselves the land of the free. How can we say that without embracing freedom technology? How can we continue to say that without embracing freedom technology and sending that signal to the world? So that's my take on what you asked, but also maybe a tie back to the initial questions about why I got into doing the political correspondent work.
Awesome. No, but I totally get you because I Actually, I loved your approach because the thing, I think we do some similar stuff because I also cover as much as I can happening in El Salvador, but also, of course, globally, because one of the main goals in the podcast is that first, that Salvadorians know what is going on in our own country. But second of all, that is not just something that Bukele embraced because it's not like that. The story is deeper, right?
We 100%.
Know. We Bitcoiners know where it comes from the Bitcoin Beach and the El Santo, etc. There's so much deep stuff. So that's part of the things that I want to cover, like globally the mainstream, but also the grassroots efforts, like, for example, the Node Nation is doing that. It's
yep.
super powerful just
yep.
them to make kids learn about Bitcoin from the technical to everything that you need to know, even to mining, right? So that's actually another thing that I want to ask you, that because you have covered a lot of those things. So
yeah.
I don't know if you have several or so many probably one story that you can share that truly move you while covering all these things.
There's many stories that have moved me, but I'll give a shout out to more of a story that continues to move me. That's Bitcoin Dada. So Bitcoin Dada is a program specifically for African women. And I've taught or whatever, I've done, I guess, lectures in this program. Run by a woman named Lorraine Marcel and some other women who help her, and mostly in Kenya, but in other parts of Africa as well. And so women in Eastern Africa, they don't inherit property. I think it's kind of difficult for them to own property. And so something like Bitcoin is something that they can own without anybody kind of knowing the better. And they can own it for many different reasons. Maybe some of them are leaving a relationship that's not good for them and they need some of their own assets to stand on their own 2 feet. Great. Bitcoin is great. Generally speaking, you know, women have a lot of say in finances globally. I think that's underreported, but in Africa, that's part of the story as well. So now we have a better asset, a better money for them to use to manage finance. Women also do something in Africa and parts of Africa called Chama. And Chama is like a community savings program, and they used to save in Kenyan shillings. It's like a pool of money that you can use to, I guess, maybe help if there's an emergency in the community or to save for other reasons. Yeah, it's like your local community savings program. Some of them are using Bitcoin now. Another app that's been created in Africa is called Bitcoin Chama. So people actually use the app to do Chama with now. And so when I see that, I see people becoming genuinely empowered, becoming included in a financial system, becoming having something to call their own, assets to call their own, and then building solutions to fit their own, to fix their own problems. And I get teary-eyed when I say this because it's just like a lot of my work before this. I was in like human services, and I taught immigrants for 12 years. So I was a we say like inglés como segundo idioma, so like English as a second language teacher. And then also I was a writing professor, but I only taught immigrants in my classes. So like I only taught you if your native language was not English. So I'd help you with like grammatical structure and things like that on top of your college writing. And I also was a social worker. I was training to be a social worker, counseling people like a therapist or whatever. So in a lot of those systems, it feels a lot of times like you're putting a Band-Aid on something. Like the problem is too big and you really can't fix it. And you're just sort of putting a Band-Aid on it. And it really relies on like me, the person administering the services. And it's not a great feeling because it's heavy. For me, it's heavy. The person walks away maybe not feeling totally empowered. But what I see with Bitcoin, especially in a case like Bitcoin Dada, is women, you know, those who have been historically financially disenfranchised, feeling empowered, teaching other people how to do the same thing. And that having a tremendous ripple effect. It's really, 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 I wish people could see this stuff up close. I constantly tell people when they complain, like, oh, like the American Bitcoin Conference is too big or this or that. I was just like, go to a community, go to Adopting Bitcoin in El Salvador, go to the African Bitcoin Conference. You will not come back with complaints. I'll tell you that. And you'll see a lot of people who are doing amazing, amazing work. And a lot of very brilliant developers, you know, from both continents, Latin America and Africa, that are just doing incredible work in developing technology to solve problems. So generally speaking, that sort of story is the stuff that really moves me. And I'll give a quick shout out to my buddy, Brendan. He has a program called, he does Bitcoin Kampala in Uganda, which is sort of like a bigger circular economy project. But one of the projects within that project is Orphans of Uganda. And this is an orphanage that now runs on Bitcoin, and it's a school, an orphanage. And again, you know, it's just, these are amazing stories that you would think the liberal media in the United States would pick up on, and they don't. And I don't know why. I think they just hate Bitcoin, but why isn't that story being reported by CNN? I don't know. Try to help him report it in whatever ways we can. But these are really beautiful stories of people using Bitcoin as a technology to actually solve human problems and to make a situation on the ground better for human beings.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're in the middle of the podcast. So I already told you that we have a game in the podcast. So now's the time. So my previous guests are from Europe. There are two guys that works in Bull Bitcoin. I don't know if you know this. They're Canadians, but they have expanded globally right now. So yeah, I met these guys in the Barcelona Cypherpunk conference. Great guys. So they came and shared their Bitcoin story. So they have, in your cases, especially because you have two questions from them. So yeah, they are really unfiltered people. So
they're the Bull Bitcoin crew. I appreciate it. Cypherpunk AF, as we would say. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to share with you.
Frank Corva, do you spend Bitcoin? And if yes, what's the craziest thing you ever bought?
Yeah, that's a good one. What's the taste of politician dicks?
Noah, don't worry. You're only the messenger. That's my question.
Yes, I spend Bitcoin. Craziest thing I ever bought, Bitcoin? I guess I wouldn't call it crazy, but I guess I never thought I'd pay for a cab ride in Kenya with Bitcoin. You know, I was just telling you how I use Tando, and I think I wouldn't call it crazy, but I just didn't expect to go to Kenya and be able to use Bitcoin almost anywhere I went. So I think that was maybe, that's the best thing I could think of off the top of my head. Otherwise, it's usually just like smaller items, coffee, whatever, you know, sometimes yeah. I buy stuff from like the Lightning store or something like that. But I would just say maybe the most unexpected, I'll substitute his word for crazy for unexpected, paying for cab rides to get around, Kenya with Bitcoin, I think was definitely one of the more shocking things. I just didn't think that would happen so quickly. Politicians. Yeah. Well, it's not, I get his point, and I know the Bull Bitcoin crew, and I just actually interviewed Francis, for a piece I wrote for Bitcoin Magazine. I love the spirit of Bull Bitcoin, so I don't take offense to the question. But I will say, I don't think, you know, I know he's joking, but I don't think that's fair. I'll put it that way. When I speak with politicians, I ask them about things like their feelings on the Samurai case and the Tornado Cash case. I don't just say, hey, tell me how great it would be if the U.S. had an SBR or if we, you know, Donald Trump is so great or blah, blah, blah. Like, at the same time, I let them share their victories. If they're doing good stuff, I always give them space to share the good stuff. But I constantly tell them that there are real issues at play, and the prosecution and persecution of open source developers is a real issue. And I bring that up with them. And so I would say to most people, before you critique me, think about whether or not if you were sitting down with them, you could do that in a way where they don't just throw you out of the room. That's because they would otherwise. It's very easy for me not to get invited to any of these events and not to get invited back to any of these events. So I do it in a way where ideally we make incremental gains and we push the conversation forward. I will say this as well. I have been asked to do certain things politically, where not only did I say no, but I offered to resign from my position. I said, I will resign before I do those things. And so just so that people know, I'm not here to throw softballs at politicians or whatever, but I am here to treat them as human beings. And I know some of you might hate politicians and don't want me to treat them as human beings, but I try to treat all people as human beings. So when I sit down with them, I like to try to say, okay, like, tell me about the good stuff you got going on. And then usually, I've been very clear, you know, open about this. I usually make sure to have one or two very difficult questions that might make them uncomfortable too. But I ask them in a way where I say, look, you know, this isn't just about me. The Bitcoin community cares about these things. What do you have to say about them? If people don't like those answers, that's not on me. The politicians can say whatever they want, you know.
Absolutely.
But in the meantime, you know, I do my best, I think, given my circumstances. And again, someone who believes in even like the spirit of Bull Bitcoin, I believe in what they're doing immensely. But I also believe in democracy, and I know that might be like an unsexy thing to say. And if we're going to have a democracy, we should partake in it, and we should speak with the leaders and hold them accountable to the best of our ability. So that'd be my sort of diplomatic answer to what he's to the second question.
All right, thank you. Yeah, actually, that's a really good question that came to my mind where we were talking, like, if you were advising the politician, or more concretely the White House, what would your idea of Bitcoin policy look like? Bitcoin policy.
Yeah, I mean, something with the minimus exemptions. We need to see policy that codifies into law the right for people to hold their private keys. So technically, under the First Amendment, we're allowed to do that. Freedom of speech, code of speech. Those are my two biggest things. And I would just say now I would have to, I would just say we need to think about privacy. I follow a lot what's going on with the Samurai case and the Tornado Cash cases. I am very sympathetic to the fact that bad actors use this tech. I'm very sympathetic to that. I don't want to see North Korean hackers using, crypto mixers to get out of things. But it's like any other technology. We have to keep an open mind because I've said this. I interviewed the former chairman of the CFTC. That's the Commodities and Future Trading Commission. I said, let's say we all move to blockchains. Generally speaking, blockchains, stablecoins, Bitcoin, all that stuff. I was like, do you want everybody to see your balance? Every time you make a transaction, buy coffee, do you want everyone to see your transactional history? Because that's where we're going if we don't have privacy, technology that creates privacy. And he said yes, and he's just said his point was, I'm hoping that the technology just gets better where we can still maintain privacy but maybe also root out bad actors. I don't know if that's going to exist. So I would say to whoever I'm working with that I think that they should have a stance on even the tough things. And I don't, if I'm just advising them, I can't tell them what their stance should be. I mean, obviously I would say be pro crypto mixers or whatever, but what looks bad is when you're asked the tough questions and you don't have anything to say about them, because what it looks like is like you're waiting for your talking points from like the president or whatever. And people, I think intuitively people sort of think of you as a bit of a, I don't mean this meanly, but like a bit of a tool for the system. Like you're just saying whatever they're telling you to say, the people above you are telling you to say. So my advice would be think about all of the tough questions that people will ask you about Bitcoin and have answers to them. And if you don't, tell them, hey, I don't fully understand that. Let me get back to you in a day or two, but then also to get back to them. So I think creating that kind of stuff is what fosters trust and it makes the Bitcoin community think like, okay, some people, I know the bull Bitcoin crowd will never get behind politicians, and that's fine. And I love that. To be honest, I love that about them. I think that that's great. But for everybody else who does want to engage on some level or hopefully like support the proponents out there, you have to have real answers to questions. That's my biggest thing. Most people, politicians go through media training. They're given talking points. Most people can see right through that stuff. And I it drives me nuts too. I have to sit across with them and they go over their talking points and I'm like, okay, you did all your talking points, now like let's actually have a conversation, like what are we going to talk about here. You have to be thoughtful in the way that you do that, because I get why they have their talking points, and like sometimes it's like, okay, this is what the Republican Party thinks, so I'm just going to sort of speak based on the party line or whatever. That's fine. But I think just to stand out, to be authentic, to be real, as real as possible in that situation, think about the tough questions. Come up with not only, your approach to it, but like come up with a thoughtful way to approach it and acknowledge the challenge in answering the question. You know, we don't want bad people doing bad things. Nobody wants that. Well, some people do, but like, I don't want that. But I do want good people, like activists, like Alexei Navalny's people and political activists around the world, pro-democracy activists. I want them to be able to not only maintain their own privacy in transacting, but the privacy of their donors. And when their donors donate, most pro-democracy activists around the world are on terrorist lists. They're literally like, if you're a pro-democracy leader in Kazakhstan, the government considers you a terrorist. Anna Chekovich, who worked with Alexei Navalny, is literally on the Russian terrorist list. She's like the sweetest human being you ever met, but she's on a Russian terrorist list. So we in the United States should not have the same approach as people who are declaring people Russian terror. We need to embrace technology that is going to help people, save lives by maintaining anonymity and also helping to fund these pro-democracy movements. So again, yeah, it's important to have answers to this. And I have spoken with politicians more on the state level who do have answers to this, and they are pro the technology, and they're very confident in saying that. So it's not that this doesn't exist. There are politicians who have thought about these tougher issues. I just hope more of them do it. And if I were advising someone, I would tell them to be one of the politicians who does it.
Absolutely. You also mentioned that, well, and we have seen that you have been covering a lot of the Tornado Cash case. I didn't want to focus in this episode about that because I think you're doing a great job, and I know that you will still cover on that.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking that probably the audience, if there's something that they need to know right now.
You have to speak. Yeah, you have to speak up. Mixers are a really delicate thing because, again, there are a lot of bad people using them. I'm not going to deny that, but there's also a lot of good people using them. But I think they finally reached the goal. So Roman Storm just raised $2 million to help fund his legal defense. But you can go to, if you Google P2P, the letter P, the number 2, and then P, P2PRights.org, I think, or P2P Rights Fund. If you look that up, it's Zach Shapiro from the Bitcoin Policy Institute is running that. And that's also raising money for the Samurai case for their defense. And if you care about this technology, if you care about privacy as we transact more across the internet, put your money where your mouth is. Like, you know, the Tornado Cash case, it's been very tense. I've been in the courtroom for two of the first 5 days. I had to go to DC for work later this week, so I couldn't stay there, but I'll be back tomorrow. They're pushing very hard to not have this stuff labeled as privacy technology. They're pushing to have it labeled as like something that only bad actors use. The judge and the prosecution, they object whenever Roman Storm's defense says like, oh no, this is like privacy, blah, blah, blah. So the defense needs support. They obviously need financial support to do what they're doing. You know, and also speak up. I mean, speak up online if you believe that this prosecution is unfair. And I would say that's the biggest thing, probably funding the people who are already involved, given the fact that Tornado Cash is already at trial and Samurai is going to trial, I think, in November. These are very pivotal cases. For people who don't know, please do your homework. If you Google the PGP wars of the 1990s, I can't think of Phil Zimmerman, I'm pretty sure, but if you Google Zimmerman and the PGP wars, PGP was called Pretty Good Privacy, and this was the fight over encryption on the internet in America. And this was more to encrypt messaging, but like not like WhatsApp, but any sort of information on the internet. The government argued that it should not exist. The average person shouldn't be able to use encryption because it's a munition, meaning like it's a gun or it's like a weapon. And the way that the defense won that case is they printed the code on a T-shirt and said code is free speech. So it's a really amazing case, and you should understand it. But now the Tornado Cash and Samurai cases are sort of what comes next, using encryption plus privacy-preserving technology to send value across the internet. And will this be allowed? We don't know. This is how big the stakes are. Are we going to be able to transact privately across the internet? Whether you agree with whether we should or not, that's up to you, but it's something to pay attention to if you care one way or the other. And I have plenty of people who think Tornado Cash, it's terrible, blah, blah, blah. They're in my comments telling me that, and that's fine. Everybody's entitled to their opinion. But I would say pay attention, and I would just say, just remember, like, maybe you're not an activist or you've never been debanked or you're not on a terrorist list, but it happens. It sometimes happens to the best of us out there. You know, the people that I think are on those lists never expected to be on those lists, and to be able to accept donations anonymously to support some of the work they're doing when they're not clearly not terrorists, the total opposite. It's really important. And you're fighting to sort of preserve this technology, you're fighting to preserve the work that these people are doing as well. So just keep that in mind. Follow along as best as possible. I'll give a shout out to some other writers covering it because I'm not there every day. So David Morris is covering it for The Rage. He used to write for CoinDesk, therage.com, though. Then you have someone covering it. I think it's Alex is covering it for DL News. You have Eleanor Terrett covering it for Crypto in America. You have a woman named Cheyenne covering it for CoinDesk. So if you're not following me for the Tornado Cash case, I just sort of, if you Google some of those things I just said, you'll see plenty of other people writing about this. And between all of us, you should be able to get a good idea of what's happening. The case will not be broadcast. It will not be rebroadcast. And we can't even have our computers in the courtroom. All we're doing is taking handwritten notes and then coming out and writing about it. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, and good luck with that because it's a huge case. So yeah, and thank you for because you're covering it a lot. So and
yeah, my pleasure
as well. Yeah, man. All right, we're gonna start wrap it up. It's time to go.
Cool.
There's a lot of things that I would like to ask you. Probably we'll do a second episode in the future when you.
Yeah, have happy to come back. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, thank you.
My pleasure.
But yeah, just I think one closer question will be like for any listener that who wants to get involved in something similar to what you do, like in journalism and advocacy, or just learning. What's the best advice that you could give to them?
Don't get discouraged, which means don't give up. I wrote for the first year where virtually nobody cared. I mean, nobody cared. Even the second year was like, okay, some people are starting to care. And then the third year, a few more people. And I didn't start at Bitcoin Magazine until 3 years into starting my writing career in this space. And, I mean, I was a journalist a long time ago as a music journalist while I was in the music business and stuff. But don't get discouraged. Just continue to build at a rate, whatever that rate is. So if it's like you on building a podcast, listener by listener, subscriber by subscriber, just keep doing that. And as you're building, obviously acknowledge your audience, listen to your audience. What do they want to know about? What guests do they want to see? What topics do they want to see covered? And make it a dialogue. Don't just make it you talking at them. Listen to what they're saying. Respond to what they're saying. But with journalism, I think big decision you have to make is whether or not to write under your real name or a pseudonym. I think the more people writing under their real name, the better. I understand why some people can't, but I think it's really good that we do this. Like I write under my real name because I know when people Google me, they'll also see, okay, he used to be a professor and he used to do this and humanitarian work. So it's not just like, oh, I'm just like a guy that loves Bitcoin and I'm crazy about Bitcoin. It's like I've done work with human beings before I found Bitcoin, and I think that's a part of my story. So just make sure to be, to make those decisions. And also do your best to stay away from just sort of cheering the slogans like have fun staying poor and do that. Like they're fine. They're like part of the memes and that kind of stuff. But if you're going to be a writer, you have a unique experience in this world, whether it's where you're from in the world or what you've done with your life. Factor that into what you do, because as you sort of build your tribe and the people who read your work and all that stuff, you're going to want to build with people who are like you, and you're going to want to attract readers who sort of maybe get you. So don't sort of cling to the things that every Bitcoiner says or, you know, the memes and all that stuff. You could do some of that. That's fine. But like be an authentic human being and tie your human experience into what you're doing and talk to people about why that's important to you. And an example of that for me is like I've lived in Venezuela. I've seen hyperinflation begin with my own two eyes. So I want there to be a technology in the world that can prevent that. And that's what Bitcoin is. So it's like adding that sort of stuff in. And if you think, well, I haven't done that many things, it's not that interesting. I've never lived in Venezuela. It's like, we've all done interesting things. We all have a place to start. Don't talk badly to yourself like that. Just do it piece by piece. Don't get discouraged and don't worry about building slowly. The more slowly you sort of build it, the more sustainable I think your readership and your base of listeners will become.
All right. Frank, thank you very much for all the advice and all the heads up and all the insights that you have given. wish you good luck again.
Thank you
for stopping by the Bitcoiner podcast. You're always welcome to come.
Thank you so much. Thank you guys for listening. And Juan, thank you so much for the invite. Sincerely appreciate it, my friend.
Thank you. Guys, see you next week. Ciao.